From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This month, award-winning poet Joy Harjo was named the next Poet Laureate of the United States. She is the first Native American to be given the honor, and so if we may, let's just listen to some of her words. In the last days of the fourth world, I wish to make a map for those who would climb through the hole in the sky. My only tools were the desires of humans as they emerged from the killing fields, from the bedrooms, and the kitchens. For the soul is a wanderer with many hands and feet. Well, that is from Harjo's poem, A Map to the Next World. And in it, you hear her powerful belief that poetry is a tool for both disruption and creation. And now she brings that belief, tied in with her own life experience as a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation, to a broad national audience. So this hour on Point, a conversation with the new U.S. Poet Laureate, Joy Harjo. And you can join us. Does Harjo's poetry resonate with you? Do you hear yourself, your story, in her reflections about resilience, oppression, spirituality, or femininity? What is your question for the next Poet Laureate of the United States? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Joy Harjo joins us today from Tulsa, Oklahoma. She's also a musician and an activist, and her latest collection, An American Sunrise, comes out this fall. Joy Harjo, welcome to On Point.
Well, it's really nice to be here with you, Meghna.
It's a great pleasure to have you, and congratulations on being named the next U.S. Poet Laureate. It's been a couple of days now. Has the news settled in with you?
Yes and no. Yeah, it's quite an honor, and it's been quite a ride in this last week. I didn't expect it. I was told what was going to happen or what might happen, but nothing can really prepare you for it.
Well, just so people know, Carla Hayden, who's the Librarian of Congress, this is what she said about your work. She says, Harjo's work powerfully connects us to the earth and the spiritual world with direct, inventive lyricism that helps us reimagine who we are. So is that how you see what your poetry does?
Probably something like it. Yeah, I like the way she said that. My poetry my poetry in a way is beyond me. I figure I'm the hammer and nails person, and then I have to give it space, and then I work with it. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's something like that.
Okay, well, let's give folks a chance to hear more of you actually reading your own work. And forgive me if I kind of slaughtered reading the verse from one of your poems in the introduction here. So I'd love to hear you read. Would you mind reading An American Sunrise to us?
Yes, I'll read this. And it's called The Golden Shovel Form that Terence Hayes invented. And it's so I've got the last word of each line is part of a poem by Gwendolyn Brooks, who is, I think, the first African-American poet laureate. So this is an American sunrise. Excuse me. We were running out of breath. As we ran to meet ourselves, we were surfacing the edge of our ancestors' fights and ready to strike. It was difficult to lose days in the Indian bar if you were straight, easy if you played pool and drank to remember to forget. We made plans to be professional and did, and some of us could sing. So we drummed a firelit pathway up to those starry stars. Sin was invented by the Christians, we sang. We were the heathens, but needed to be saved from them. Thin chance, we knew we were all related in this story. A little gin will clarify the dark and make us all feel like dancing. We had something to do with the origins of blues and jazz. I argued with the music as I filled the jukebox with dimes in June. 40 years later, and we still want justice. We are still America. We know the rumors of our demise. We spit them out. They die soon.
Huh. That's Joy Harjo reading her poem, An American Sunrise. Remind me, when did you wrote this in 2017, right?
Yes. Well, actually, I think I wrote it 2018.
Oh, okay.
No, you're right. I did write it in 2017. It's kind of the lead-off poem for the whole book.
Right. And so what inspired An American Sunrise?
Well, at my age, sometimes you can get a little nostalgic, and then sometimes you look back. You take time. It's important for all of us, no matter what age, to take time to look back. And I was thinking about all the struggles of all of us in this country and how we've, so many of us have worked for justice, for equal rights, for human rights and women's rights, native rights, and then sometimes you think, oh, man, nothing's changed at all. nothing has changed. And then other times you look and it's like there's so much life running through us. It's a gift from the earth, and here we are. Mm. And you look into the eyes of the children and grandchildren, and they're all, the way I was taught is that all of the children and all of the grandchildren belong to all of us. And then when you look in their eyes and you hear them and you hear their poetry or even their own poetry of being, and you know that it's going to work out.
Mm. So in the words, the way I was taught, it makes I want to explore with you so much about how you, the path that your life has taken and how you've arrived at this place. But before we do that, I should have just asked you this right at the top of the show. What does it mean to you that you were the first Native person, Native woman, to be named the Poet Laureate of the United States?
I don't even know if I have the words yet. I've been saying a lot of different things, but it's overwhelming, it's immense, and yet it's an honor. And I think of all that it took to get here, all of the teachers, all of the mentors, from my own people, the Muscogee Creek Nation, and my relatives there, and then an Indian country. I've been all through in all of my life. You know, my work has all been about that, and all of America and all these different. I've been so much a part of multicultural poetic movements and an American poet, all of it. I've had so many mentors and so many. I've talked and worked with so many people through the years, and it's part of everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody along the road, because I wouldn't be here without them.
So I didn't mean to be a little confusing. I might have been to some listeners before. I should just be explicit. You are the first Native person to have been named the Poet Laureate of the United States, the 23rd that we've had so far in the history of this country. You can do whatever you want in this coming year during your tenure as Poet Laureate. Do you know what you want to do? It's a huge platform to explore, to connect, to write about this country.
It is a huge platform, and I would like to have a little moment to sit with it and to really, I figure I've got a huge team, and it reaches through all corners of this country, and so I just need to sit with it. But of course, like many people in this country, I'm concerned about how we hear each other.
Okay.
And poetry is the best venue for that, actually. Yeah.
I appreciate your desire just to sit with things for a little while. I'll relax from the urgency of now here. So tell us, Joy, when did poetry first come into your life?
Poetry first came in through music, through my mother's songwriting, her lyrics. But she also loved William Blake and the other, you know, poems that she learned as a schoolgirl growing up. And she loved rhythmic words, that was my first doorway to poetry. And then my eighth birthday, I asked for books of poetry for my birthday and was given a Louis Untermeyer Treasury of Poetry book. And that book stayed with me most of my life.
Why is that?
I've always loved what a poem can do, what it can hold. It's like singing, and I think of poetry as singing language, even though there's all kinds of poetry and there's all kinds of singing too. And it's a poem can hold history. It can hold all the people that you love. It can stand up against someone you're trying to help understand it, you know. And we need poetry. We have poetry is what we turn to at every transitional and transformational event in our lives. Mm. When there's a child born, we turn to poetry. When there's a marriage, we turn to poetry. When there's death or we're dying, we turn to poetry when we're grieving, when we're falling in love, when we're falling out of love.
Yeah. Well, there's a quote in the Washington Post from you where you say that poetry came to me at a point in which I had no words to express the depth of experience of being native in this country. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, I was a student at the University of New Mexico, and a lot was coming at me. I was a young mother, a single mother with two children, working, going to school full time, and we were in the involved in community action work for Native communities in the New Mexico area. I was going to school in New Mexico, and then there were the National Native Rights Movements, and we were all looking at, you know, who we were and are as Native peoples, which is a very different kind of story than the story that's usually told in America. In the American story, which goes back to the American Sunrise poem, is that, you know, we were running around here we were heathens and even devils, as Cotton Mather says, and, you know, we were not really human beings. And then, you know, so, and that's not so. Mm-hmm. We come from over 500 tribal groups, a lot of dignity, stories, poetry. We're human beings.
Yeah. Well, we're talking this hour with Joy Harjo. She is the incoming poet laureate for the United States. What's your question for her? We're going to take a quick break with some of Joy's music. This is Going Home off her 2008 album, Winding Through the Milky Way. This is On Point.
I'm from Oklahoma, got no one to call mine. A love supreme, a love supreme. Everybody wants a love supreme.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Joy Harjo. She is an award-winning poet and now the incoming U.S. Poet Laureate. She is the first Native person ever to be given that honor by the Library of Congress. She joins us today from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and you can join us. What's your question for Joy Harjo? What is your question for the next U.S. Poet Laureate? And what does it mean that the nation has finally honored a Native person to represent the voice of the entire country in poetry? Joy, if I may, I'd love to hear more about, you know, your growing up as a Native woman in Tulsa. I mean, tell us more about what your childhood was like and what your early influences were. Because, you know, before the break, you were saying that how the nation views Native people is not at all, of course, how Native people view themselves. So tell us more of your story about growing up.
Yes, I grew up in Tulsa, and Tulsa is part of the Muscogee Creek Nation. And so even though it was a city, a small city, everybody, all of my neighbors are Creek, Seminole, Cherokee, and non-Natives. And we're just like many other, you know, other people going about their lives. And then we still, though, we kept our music going. We kept, we kept ourselves going culturally. But it's something that you don't always see in the everyday because, you know, we're out there with you. Mm. And then, you know, then the language. I didn't have the language because so many of our fathers and mothers and grandparents were forbidden to speak the language. So I'm always thankful to those in our tribal communities who, you know, keep that going.
So the I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
Well, but because language and an erasure of a people by erasing their language and suppressing their language is a major part of how, you know, of the centuries-long mistreatment of Native peoples here. I was, you know, all in that same vein, when reading about your early experiences, you gave a previous interview where you had talked about how when you went to the Institute of American Indian Arts, that in the same classrooms where you were taking your classes, there were still, you know, stoves in those classrooms, because a generation before that, what Native women had been taught was, you know, using stoves in order to teach them how to clean other people's homes. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, that was in the classroom for my English class, yeah. And later I went back and taught there, and the stoves were still there. And that wasn't that long before. Now, Institute of American Indian Arts used to be a Bureau of Indian Affairs school with Musley High School, and that's when I went there. Now it's a full-blown arts college in Santa Fe. It's wonderful. But, yes, and just a generation or two, you know, just before, that was, there were, you know, that's what it was. And in the back of the school, there were still dairy barn remnants from when the boys were taught how to farm. And that's a whole part of the really kind of the sordid history of it's this country. I mean, it's, and yet when I went to school there, it was changing, at least at that school, in so that arts became a major curriculum, because they discovered that we had a lot of our talent in the arts, and it making arts did a lot to heal our spirits and heal our spirits and heal the spirits of our particular tribal nations.
Well, I mean, talk about that. That was a time of almost a renaissance of Native contemporary art.
Yes, it was. We had teachers like Alan Hauser making sculpture. We had Fritz Schulder in painting. Ottilie Lolema in ceramic. We had an incredible crew of some of the finest artists, most of them Native artists in the country, as our mentors and as our teachers.
Yeah. You know, forgive me for dwelling on this a little bit more, but it just grabbed at my heart so much, imagining, you know, a young Joy Harjo in a classroom where there was physical evidence still in that classroom of what her people were limited to and expected to do, you know, even as you're learning about recapturing the Native narrative. It just seemed like such a striking contradiction. I'm just wondering how you felt in those classrooms seeing the evidence. I mean, I suppose you see that evidence and live that evidence every day of your life. But see.
I was going to say that. I was going to say, yes, it's everywhere. And as a kid, you're just so, as a teenager, you're living in the time you live in now. And we were so excited with what was happening. I mean, it was what was happening in the country and the whole, you know, we're all part of that, too. You know, a generation is a generation across cultures. And so in our generation across the country and, you know, in America, it was the time of people standing up against, you know, the Vietnam War, looking at, you know, who are we, what does it mean, what does love mean? there were all these questions, you know, it's kind of percolating through everybody. And so, you know, just like other Americans, we were into the music and Jimi Hendrix and, you know, all of that. But at the same time, we're thinking, and, you know, even as very young artists, most of us were in high school, we would have these long discussions about, well, what does it mean to be an artist from, you know, we're from our particular tribes and our particular nations. What does it mean to carry art? Because it doesn't just belong to us. Most of us came from a long tradition of artists. And then there's a certain way that you think and feel and are that the art is. You don't have to think about it. And often it's very different from the mainstream art.
Yeah.
And yet there's a conversation always going on, you know, intertribally within your own people and nationally and internationally. I mean, the world is so linked, and we know that. I mean, when NASA released that image of Earth in the late 60s of this beautiful, incredible being that shifted I think it shifted global consciousness. Like, you know, this is us.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we take care of us?
Yeah, you know? That Earthrise picture, right?
Yeah.
How do you answer that question today, the one that you and your contemporaries were asking each other as young people about what does it mean as a Native person to carry the meaning of, you know, of your people in your art? How do you answer that question today?
Well, every human is who they are, you know, and you come up. It's not something that's self-conscious. Well, I don't sit there at when I'm writing and working thinking, well, I am a Muscogee Creek person. What does that mean? I'm there with my art, and mm-hmm. that's part of it
mm-hmm.
because that's how it was given to me, and it moves through me that way.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I grew up in this community, and I've traveled all over the world, lived a lot in New Mexico. I've lived in Hawaii and even L.A. for a few years, et cetera. But this is the root, and the root goes all the way back into the southeastern part of the U.S.
Yeah.
It's a deep root, and with so many stories, so many complex stories. Everyone is so different.
Are questions like that annoying? I often wonder, because I have to say I ask that of many people who come on the show, because I wonder if sometimes people just want to say, yes, I mean, look, I carry the burden of representation simply by existing, let alone as being an artist. Is it fair to even ask people that question?
Well, I think so. I think it's, you know, I think, you know, especially in this is a very young country. And yet indigenous peoples, we've been here, you know, almost forever. So it's a young country. So we're watching what happens and we watch identity. So if you think of a young country and you think of identity and you think of all these incredible stories and peoples, the immigrants and all the incredible numbers of different Native nations in this whole hemisphere and all of these stories, what amazing stories. And it's quite a gift, actually. It's because diversity of stories, just like diversity of languages, you know, diversity of poetry, diversity is what grows an ecosystem or a cultural system.
Yeah. Well, let's go to our callers. We are talking this hour with Joy Harjo. She, this month, was named the United States Poet Laureate, the next U.S. Poet Laureate. She's an award-winning poet and musician. She's got a memoir out from several years ago called Crazy Brave, and her latest collection of poetry, An American Sunrise, will be published in August. Let's go to Ken, who's calling from Rapid City, South Dakota. Ken, you're on the air.
Hello, I am Oglala Lakota, and for me, it's even more significant that Joy is the laureate, not just because she's Native American, but because her poetry addresses the true Native American experience in America. And I just think that anybody could be a good poet and choose any other subject matter, but her Native American heritage really shines through her poetry, and I think that that's important to acknowledge that. And I'm wondering if Joy thinks that with the emotional attachment that comes with poetry, if that will be a more effective way of translating the Native American experience to non-Native Americans than previous approaches from like AIM or NAC, which is the Native American Church, which tended to be more aggressive and more retaliatory.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Joy, what do you say to Ken?
I say, Mado Ken, thanks for calling so much. And I've had a good time up in your part of the world and with your people through the years. And I think that's a good question, because I think what it is, poetry is the kind of language in poetry. You don't go to poetry for any kind of political ranting. Of course, I guess you can. You can use poetry in many other kinds of ways, but poetry has a different kind of demand to it, at least my experience of poetry. Mm. It demands another kind of language, you know, that a language that you have to stop and listen to. And often those things that you have to stop and listen to, like the voice of the the trees or the voice of, you know, how the Creator works in everybody. And that voice, you can't get there if you're yelling. Yeah.
Well, this is the perfect way to have us listen to more of your poems, because I definitely want to stop and hear and listen. So would you mind reading the first section of your 1983 poem, She Had Some Horses? This is the one that everyone says. It's the Joy Harjo poem.
Well, let's see. I have the whole poem here, but you said just the first section?
Well, so the first section, which is 1, 2, 3. I'm trying to count the stanzas. 4, 5, 6, 7-ish stanzas, something like
that? Well, that's the whole poem. I'll just read. And this poem came from... These poems come when I'm not... They're often larger than me. And I would just sit. I remember sitting at night, and then this... Of course, I revised it. I'm still revising a little of it, but it's like, and there's a whole history of horses with my family, so she had some horses. She had horses who were bodies of sand. She had horses who were maps drawn of blood. She had horses who were skins of ocean water. She had horses who were the blue air of sky. She had her horses who were fur and teeth. She had horses who were clay and would break. She had horses who were splintered red cliff. She had some horses. She had horses with eyes of trains. She had horses with full brown thighs. She had horses who laughed too much. She had horses who threw rocks at glass houses. She had horses who licked razor blades. She had some horses. She had horses who danced in their mother's arms. She had horses who thought they were the sun and their bodies shone and burned like stars. She had horses who waltzed nightly on the moon. She had horses who were much too shy and kept quiet in stalls of their own making. She had some horses. She had horses who liked creek stomp dance songs. She had horses who cried in their beer. She had horses who spit at male queens who made them afraid of themselves. She had horses who said they weren't afraid. She had horses who lied. She had horses who told the truth, who were stripped bare of their tongues. She had some horses. She had horses who called themselves horse. She had horses who called themselves spirit and kept their voices secret unto themselves. She had horses who had no names. She had horses who had books of names. She had some horses. She had horses who whispered in the dark, who were afraid to speak. She had horses who screamed out of fear of the silence, who carried knives to protect themselves from ghosts. She had horses who waited for destruction. She had horses who waited for resurrection. She had some horses. She had horses who got down on their knees for any savior. She had horses who thought their high price had saved them. She had some horses. She had some horses she loved. She had some horses she hated. These were the same horses.
That's Joy Harjo reading her 1983 poem, She Had Some Horses. I don't even know what to ask. I was carried along there with your reading. What are you saying in this poem?
Well, I keep thinking of Ken's question about the note about emotional attachment, and any creation in the world, even scientific study, there's an emotional link to being that or to going in that direction. And I was thinking about how old I was when I wrote this poem, which is much larger than a young woman in her 20s. Late 20s, early 30s. I mean, it was so much more, and so much is entwined in that. There's this entwined, and here's the story of my grandfather, about six generations Manahwe, who was known to have a way with horses. In here is all that angst, like, that we all go through, you know, especially at that age, and when you're trying to balance home and family and all the things that go on, and this sound of poetry that comes out of the deep and comes out of the spiritual world we're all in.
Well, we are talking this hour with Joy Harjo. She is an award-winning poet and the incoming poet laureate of the United States. We will take a quick break here and listen to Joy's instrumental Rainbow Gratitude from her 2010 album, Red Dreams, A Trail Beyond Tears. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Joy Harjo. She's a musician and an award-winning poet, and now the incoming Poet Laureate for the United States. She's a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation and the first Native person to serve as Poet Laureate of the United States. Let's go to Mary Lou, who's calling from Essex Junction, Vermont. Mary Lou, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm so thrilled that Joy has won this award. She truly deserves it, and she inspired me many years ago when I heard her read that poem, She Had Some Horses, and just hearing you read it now brought tears to my eyes, Joy. And thank you so much, and I know that you're going to be speaking to our nation with a voice that we so much need to hear. Thank you again.
Mary Lou, don't go away. What is it about, She Had Some Horses, that poem that we all just heard Joy read, what is it that moves you so much?
Just that she reached into my heart and soul, all the things that we all feel, and it's hard to find the words. It just it's so powerful and inspiring because I think many of us feel those feelings, and she put it into words, and it's like, yes, we all feel these things, and we have to accept the good and the bad.
Yeah.
You know, they were both the same horse.
Yeah. Well, Mary Lou,
we all have these two sides to us.
Yeah. Hang on, Mary Lou.
I'm supposed to be brief. So
I'm not interrupting you. I was just going to tell you to hang on. Don't go away because I wanted Joy to have a chance to talk with you. I don't want to be the interlocutor here anymore. But Joy, go ahead. What do you have to say to Mary Lou?
Thank you, Mary Lou. I really appreciate that. And yeah, I like what you were getting to about how we all have two sides. There's a polarity, and this world is a world of polarity, which is for balance, you know, and we need balance. We need balance in all things. We're all, whether it looks like it or not, we're all in the middle of a moment of all finding balance together, you know, in this country. But this poem, this poem just came because I needed that, but all of us. I've always felt like the poetry is a voice that's not—it's not really my personal voice. It's really a voice that comes from long ago, and so it wasn't always one of the. I don't think I've ever had like a popular poetry voice. It's just been what it is, and it's moved about at its own pace, and so I feel like I'm in service of it. I'm a human being with a lot of, I'm a very, I'm a faulty human being like we all are.
Well, Mary Lou, thank you so much for your call. And let's go now to Dylan, who's calling from Bath, Maine. Dylan, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. And Ms. Harjo, congratulations on a well-deserved appointment. I wanted to ask about the intergenerational conversation within Native arts and letters and how it has influenced or inspired your work. I started as a poetry student at the University of Arizona in the 90s. I was a classmate of the Navajo poet Sherwood Mitsui.
Oh, yeah.
And was always struck, it was wonderful to be there, first of all, to see poets like Lucy Dapahanso, Simon Ortiz, the writers of the previous generation, and how intimately and warmly they related to the coming generation of poets. And when I would watch Sherwin and other Native poets interact, in readings, in public fora, they were always so quick to direct attention away from themselves and to other lesser-known Native poets to try to get some accessibility and publicity to those artists as well. And I'm always struck by that activity within Native arts and letters, where I think in the broader American literary tradition, we tend to celebrate the singular celebrity of that mm-hmm. one author, whereas with Native writers, it's very much about a community of artists and writers. And I'm just curious about, first of all, how you had spoke about your experience at the Institute of American Indian Arts and being able to be exposed to the greatest artists of the time, the Native artists that were there as instructors. And of course, that goes on now. Today's instructors are instructing the next generation of Native artists. So I was wondering about how that exposure to other Native artists influenced your work.
Yeah.
And also, what Native writers are you excited about in the coming generation?
Well, Dylan, thank you for your call. Joy Harjo, what Native writers are you excited about?
Thank you for that, Dylan, and thank you for opening it up so we could talk about this intergenerational conversation, because I wouldn't have become a poet at all without, I was not going in that direction until I heard the poetry of Simon Ortiz and Leslie Silco. And even at Indian School, there were a lot of young poets. It was something we did naturally, not me. I didn't start writing until the 70s. And we always, maybe it's just this way. I don't think it's just this way with Native communities, but we certainly try to look out for those coming along with us and those following. And we all mentor each other. We've mentored, I met Sherwin Bitsui when he's a wonderful poet. I was going to say young, we're all getting older, but he's still a younger poet. When he was a student at the Institute of American Indian Arts. So I've kept in touch with him all this time. And there's Jennifer Forrester, a young Muscogee Creek poet who is, I guess she heard my poetry as a child, and now we work together on mentorship, mentoring and other young Muscogee Creek artists. And then Lewis Oliver, I have to name him as an older Creek poet. I met him when he was in his 80s. He came to a workshop I was doing and had been writing all of this verse in romantic verse. And when he heard all these Native writers, he started writing and got his first book published in his 80s. So I just want people to know that sometimes they think, well, I used to like to play saxophone or I like to write, but, you know, I'm too old. I've had people say that when they're in their 30s, and it's like, no. But, you know, that's part of it, is that we give back. And I've been so lucky to be a part of an incredible group of poets like Lucy. You mentioned Lucy Tapahunzo. I mean, there's so many. When you ask to name, I don't like to do it because I always leave so many people out. There's so many. What's so exciting about right now, there's a huge number of young Native poets mm-hmm. who are changing American poetry.
Wow.
You know, we're seen as part of the American poetry scene, so to speak. And that wasn't always the case. When I was coming up, we were sort of, you know, running alongside, maybe way back there, but here we are.
Well, let's go to Susan, who's calling from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Susan, you're on the air.
Hello, enjoy. Congratulations. I think this appointment of you in particular as America's Poet Laureate could not have come at a more wonderful time for you to be present with Americans in all kinds of communities. And I hope you'll come to Kentucky because we're great poetry lovers here. I am particularly interested in knowing what thoughts you may have about the impact of your poetry and also poets and poetry in general in helping Americans who, you know, we've all been sort of cultivated in the last few years to be thinking of how different we are from each other rather than how much alike we are.
Mm-hmm.
And how we might come together to address, in particular, what's happening to our environment.
Yeah. Susan, you're going to have to forgive me for cutting you off. It's not because of what you're saying. It's just that your phone line is a bit rough to hear. So I want to give Joy a chance to respond. Susan asking there about, can poetry, and your poetry in particular, Joy, she sees it as coming at a critical time, and especially as we think about differences between people and similarities, but more broadly, concerns over the environment.
Yes, I don't think it's just about my poetry. We were just talking about young Native poets and Native poets. You know, we always are amazed that we're all, it's like we're writing a poem alongside each other together, and you'll find in their poetry what you're finding in mine. But what I say, when we get into this place of, you know, what kind of language sets up difference, you know, it's important to think about the kind of language that allows, you know, degradation, name calling, and so on. And I think about frequencies of language, so that there's everyday language. And then there's kind of heightened language that is meant to enslave or to get something from somebody, to steal something from somebody, or just to, you know, language that is, you know, a more politicized language that's meant to, it has a different kind of focus. And then you get to the language of poetry, and that language demands, it demands that you stop and listen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how poetry, period, can be useful for right now, absolutely right now in this country and the world, because this kind of this division is going on all over the world.
Yeah, you mentioned that rich list of Native poets right now that people should be paying attention to. I also wanted to ask you about in a different interview with the poets.org website. You mentioned that it was an Adrian Rich poem that you continually turn to, Diving into the Wreck. Why that poem and why her?
Well, Adrian became a mentor of mine. I met her through Audre Lorde, and who was also a mentor. So I've been very lucky to have, you know, really incredible mentors. Leslie Silko was a mentor. But that poem, oh, man, that poem struck me, has always struck me, because we all, in order to know who we are as a person, as a part of a family, as part of a tribal nation or a cultural group, family group, as a country, as Earth, we're here, we are essentially Earth. You know, we have to dive into the meaning of that, which means diving into kind of the wreck, as Adrienne Rich calls it, to see what is there. You know, the poets go in and look at, you have to keep your eyes and ears open and see what's there, even if it is painful.
Yeah. I don't want to put you on the spot here, but do you remember are there any particular lines from the poem that really grab you?
Yes, the whole poem. And I was trying to remember because I've tried to memorize this poem. And right now I just keep thinking the wreck itself and not the wreck. Sometimes I can say a lot of it right now.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I have the luxury of having a computer right in front of me, so I have the poem in front of me.
Could you read the opening?
Have some lines here. From the interview that from poets.org, but you said there are particular parts like, I came to explore the wreck. The words are purposes. The words are maps. I came to see the damage that was done and the treasures that prevail. I mean, that's just a little snippet of the poem there. But you can already, like you're talking about, diving down deep, using poetry to dive down deep into our understanding, even our mythic understanding of this world that we live in.
Right, and it's the mythic where you're going to find the reconstruction materials in the mythic. And by mythic, I don't mean in some people say it's false or whatever, but mythic I see the mythic as kind of the field of dreams. Hmm. That lingers there in the what's been called the subconscious, and it's the building material of all that we all, you don't like to use the word hope, but all that we aspire to make a place in which we all have a place at the table, and there's plenty of food there, and no one is being, you know, the food's being, as it's being grown, it's being sung to, and no one is enslaved for the making, and we're all treated as beloved relatives.
Well, I want to take one last call. Mary is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mary, we've just got a couple seconds to go, but go ahead. What do you want to say to Joy Harjo?
Hi. Yes, thanks so much. I learned so much from NPR having these guests on. I'm sorry I had not heard of you prior, but just quickly, I'm so happy being a Native American that you are receiving this honor and that you remind me so much of Patti Smith, if you're familiar with her, her writing, her poetry, her songs and singing, and because of her depth. And you actually even sound somewhat like her. And thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mary. Joy, do you appreciate the Patti Smith comparison?
Oh, yeah, of course. She's really cool. You know, she's really cool. Like, you know, thank you.
Well, we've just got a minute left here to go, Joy. And tell us a little bit more about what do you think you might do as you start your term as U.S. Poet Laureate?
Well, I'm still thinking of a national project, which if I take on a second term, that's when that kicks in. And in a way, I'm doing what I've always done, which is what poetry has given to me to do. But I'm thinking about it in a different kind of way. And I certainly have been, too, because of the times we're in. And anytime you're given something, it's not just for you, but it's for everyone. It doesn't matter if you're the one that knows how to make, you know, fix cars or to you're the best one at... you know, whatever it is in your community, it's given to you to share. Mm. And so that's basically what I've been doing, but it's about sharing poetry, not just my poetry, and I appreciate Dylan for reminding us all that, but it's all of us. You know, it's for, it's about sharing and making connections.
Well, Joy Harjo is the incoming Poet Laureate for the United States. She is the first Native American poet to serve in that position. She's a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation, multi-award-winning poet and musician. Joy, thank you so much and congratulations again.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to close this hour with Joy Harjo's poem, Grace, set to music from her 2004 album, Native Joy for Real. This is On Point.
Say grace was a woman with time on her hands. Her white buffalo escaped from Mama Lee. But in that dingy light, it was a promise of balance. We once again understood the talk of animals. Spring was lean and hungry with the hope of children.